My guest today, Tarang Chawla, has a bulldog called Habibi. Habibi likes to sleep under his desk and occasionally roll a ball around. And in our episode today, Habibi is snoring just gently and quietly underneath a lot of our conversation. I think a gentle and great reminder that even in the most difficult times, like Melbourne lockdown that we're going through at the moment, there's always going to be someone making you laugh. So I'm Claire Tonti. Welcome to Tonts. This is a podcast about feeling all of it, about the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we are told about who we are. I want to look at where these stories come from and examine whether they are true and what we can do to unpick some of those messages that I think are holding us back. Tarang Chawla is one impressive person. He's an award-winning anti-violence campaigner and writer. He's also a trainee lawyer. He uses his background to advocate for social and political change, particularly in approaching mental health and gender equality. He also writes some really excellent tweets all about MAFS, which is a show in Australia, and I, for one, definitely appreciate his humour. Tarang also founded the Not One More Nikki movement, which is Australia's largest campaign to end violence against women in culturally diverse communities. Now, he started this after his younger sister, Nikita, was murdered in 2015 by her former partner. But as Tarang says in this episode, Nikki's story is not that ending. Nikki was a choreographer. She was warm and funny and kind. And the way that Tarang talks about her in this episode will warm your heart. Tarang is also warm and funny, and has done what I think the only way through is when it comes to the hardest, most heartbreaking moments in our lives. Like a rock under intense heat and pressure becomes a diamond, he's taken his and his family's pain and turned it into something beautiful and important that I think is making our Australian community a better and safer place to be for all of us, and especially for women. All right, here he is, Tarang Chawla, and occasionally Habibi.
Mum's family's from Delhi, Dad's family from just outside Delhi. But if we trace it back, we're technically from like the Pakistan side of the border.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, like we kind of, and Mum and Dad's family are like from like a similar area in that pre-partition side of India. But a lot of like when direct colonial rule ended in India or that region, and then India and Pakistan and Bengal, the Bengal region around Bangladesh, when all of that was formed, like we saw these kinds of lines drawn in the sand, and like it's like you're on this side, then you're from that country. If you're on this side, you're from this country. And so like families are torn apart. There's a lot of bloodshed, a lot of suffering, and like they're not comparable at all. But we're seeing this weird thing now with like coronavirus restrictions, particularly in Australia, that like you have families who live on either sides of borders, right? And then we draw like because of the line in the sand, that we see that like you can't visit those people, even though you're part of the same family, because you're led by premiers who have different like restrictions. And it's never the border communities that have the number of cases. It's always like the kind of like city hubs. So it's this strange kind of parallel where families are separated, and it's just, yeah, we're living in a really sad time, I think.
I know it is. It's really strange. So let's go back to the 90s, because that's less sad.
Yes.
You were telling me, so you moved here when you were 18 months old, and you told me your favorite movie, or one of them, was American Pie. That's a 1999 movie. I thought I'd start there.
Yeah, right.
Why American Pie? What was it about that you loved?
Oh God, I can't believe I admitted to that so freely when you asked me. Tell me about a movie that you'd seen before from your past. I don't know, because I haven't watched it in years. I don't even know that I'd find it funny anymore. But at the time, it was pretty popular, right? Like I remember thinking
huge.
I remember thinking like what were the movies that stood out? And I think I was in like year seven at the time. And I think it was like the first examples of freedom that I got, you know, like being able to go to the cinemas with my friends rather than with my parents. So it was all like, it was a confluence of all of those factors that led to me thinking, oh, this is incredible. Let's go watch this at the cinema. I don't even think it was my idea, to be honest. I think like it would have been like whoever like the ringleader in our group of all boys was. Yeah. And it was just looking back, it's very problematic.
It's so, it would never be made now, right? Because the premise is, which is so funny, because I loved it too when I saw it, even though, I mean, it's pretty gross in a lot of ways. So it's high school boys vowing by hook or by crook to lose their virginity before prom.
And it sort of feels like a game of Russian roulette with four bullets in the chamber when you look back at it now.
Yeah.
Because by their own guidelines, it had to be valid consensual sex, nothing to prostitutes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really incentivize good behavior, does it? And that kind of shows throughout the trajectory of the film, even though it's got this like really lovely line through it that's quite sweet in some ways about friendship and love. I mean, amongst really problematic, really highly explicit, kind of gross teenage boy stuff, I guess, going on. And now we wouldn't really think about it as a movie that could even be made without people throwing an uproar. I just find it so interesting, you know, looking back at movies like that now, we see them in such a different light. For you, because you work in men's advocacy, right? So you work and women's empowerment. What do you think has changed in the culture since then that makes us look back at that kind of film and go, that's problematic?
Yeah, right. I think, well, part of it is in your introduction there, Claire, around the film and like the themes of it, right? We're more attuned to themes around representation, you know, so and that, you know, can be split across race lines, across gender lines in particular. And so like all of the women, the female characters in that film they exist purely for the male gaze. They exist purely for men to either ogle them and or objectify them either visually or physically or in some form, right? So they exist as vehicles of pleasure for a very narrow men's experience, right? Like teenage, kind of like this myth or this perception of teenage boys as being testosterone laden, uncontrollable heathens, right? And it's not true. Like it's not grounded in reality. You know, certainly we have issues around teenage boys acting out, if we want to use a very, very diplomatic and very like low-key descriptor of the behavior. But that acting out is not a product of differences in like boys' development and psychology. It's a difference in the way boys are reared and nurtured and the way that boys are allowed to behave in certain ways. You know, and I'm conscious of that as a man from particularly like a South Asian background. There's a lot of behavior that boys in particularly like Indian communities get away with because of ingrained misogyny and sexism. Where it gets complicated for me is this perception that it's somehow worse in certain communities, because like growing up here, you know, for instance, if I speak Hindi, I speak Hindi in, you know, when I speak in an Australian accent, right? So it's not like my relatives there are like, oh, he's just like us. They look at me and they're like, you're definitely Australian. Like you would not survive a day here. And they're right. But it's like, it's like this perception that certain men and the community, like not just men, hold in Australia that things are like worse elsewhere. And I've always thought that's such a strange thing. And I think it's something that Australia does particularly well, which we shouldn't do, which is like look at other countries and go, oh, they're that bad or they're worse. So why does it matter here? And it's like, you know, we still have a woman a week being killed by a current or former partner. Here we still have like all of the allegations of sexual assault that have surfaced in Parliament, no less, right? So it's like if we're living in a culture where this is happening here, that's a, you know, that's something that's in our backyard. And that's something that we need to not only be mindful of, but actually work to change and shift. Mm. So for me, it's sort of like what's changed in the culture since then and now is an awareness that this exists. Like we're not even really at the point of tackling the problem, which is where we need to be, because there are people who still find ways to say, for instance, not all men. You know, when something occurs, like in the case of the murder of my sister, we had people say like, well, not all men are violent. You know, and it's like, well, no one's saying that all men are violent, but we are living in a society that has continued like a long legacy of patriarchal thinking, where like men are the figurehead and women exist around that. And that film exists as part of that culture, you know. And so now, maybe through the rise of streaming services and more people making content and having it be visible, you know, we're seeing people more adequately represented as part of the richness and diversity of communities. And I think that can only be a good thing, you know.
Mm, yeah, absolutely, because I think you touched on so many things there. Like, for instance, there's a student in the film, Nadia from Slovakia, who is seen doing a striptease and it's kind of published all over the internet and it's seen as quite a funny joke. when really it's so problematic and dangerous now, really, around that idea of consent and showing nudity of someone, you know, watching them through a webcam without their knowledge, all of those sorts of things. And it's done in such a way that, exactly right, is so flippant and is from a male gaze completely without seeing her as a fully fleshed person.
Yeah.
With her own, you know, personality.
I forgot about that webcam thing. And that's fascinating, isn't it? Because that's illegal, right? Like,
yeah,
baseline,
it is, yeah.
Like, that's very illegal. Do not do that. Film anyone without their consent. But also, I wonder how it like kind of fits around the timing of when that came out, right? Like 1999, the dot-com boom, and we were still using dial-up internet then, right? Like people now have no concept of what that is, right? They don't understand the struggle of trying to get content on the internet. Like even downloading a song, like now we stream everything, but like downloading a song and then waiting half an hour, 45 minutes for 1 5-minute song to download and then listening to it until you hated it because you could only download a couple of songs at a time. And then someone in your house needing to use the phone and then you had to stop using the internet, all of that, right? But so when it came out around then, it's fascinating because I wonder how many boys saw that and how many girls saw that and then learnt that because that's what they see, that's what's acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, and it's... We're having these discussions like around consent education in schools, right? Which is so necessary and so important. And someone asked me, what consent education did you have at school? And I don't think I had any. Like, I don't think they taught us that. I think they taught us a bit about abstinence and they taught us a little bit about like, this is how you put on a condom. And I think that was it.
Mm.
That was literally the extent of it.
What is consent for people listening who might not know?
Yeah, right. So consent, it's pretty easy to explain. Basically, it involves communication with the other partner or partners around what are the boundaries of acceptable and non-acceptable interaction in any kind of sexual scenario. So like constantly checking in. And essentially the best way to look at it is like if it's not an enthusiastic yes, then it's not consent.
Mm.
You know, like if there's coercion involved or control involved or force to get the yes, then it's not really, then you're not really getting consent. So it's, I think people complicate it, you know, like we had that national campaign from the federal government, which was around like milkshakes and things.
Oh God, it was so confusing,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And then other metaphors are used about like tea and, you know, you can change your mind at certain points. But there's this reluctance to talk to teenagers about sex as though it's a foreign concept to them. And I'm like, man, I remember being a teenager and the concept was not foreign to me then. I doubt it's foreign now. Like,
yeah, fashions have changed, but that has not changed.
Yeah, yeah. And the struggle, I mean, the downloading music struggle wasn't even the biggest struggle back then. It was the struggle to get pornography, right? Because it was like, if I'm being painfully honest, that's what it was. It was just...
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you now, going from that kind of boy, I guess, who's like, you know, struggling to get music, maybe trying to look for pornography and really into girls, and in some ways quite innocent, I guess... Do you want to talk us through what has changed for you and your story? I'm so sorry about your sister Nikita as well. I just want to start by saying that. And I know a lot of people listening won't know anything about your story and her story. Are you comfortable talking
us
through that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so my sister Nikki, there's a photo of her just there actually. She was murdered by her partner in 2015 when she was 23. And a lot of women are killed in the context of separation when like men's sense of control diminishes over their partner in relationships that were in some way abusive before, whether that's physical violence and abuse or other forms of violence. So Nikki died in similar circumstances to that. And yeah, that sort of spurred me on a path of advocacy and campaigning around women's safety, around prevention of violence against women and the attitudes, whether they're in the media or in the community, that perpetuate that cycle of abuse and control by men. But it didn't sort of start, my interest in these issues didn't start there. Like I think from a young age, been fascinated by concepts of gender and gender identity because I didn't feel like I fit into certain molds. So it wasn't like an external kind of I saw other things and, you know, were interested in them. It was more like introspection from a very young age, right? Like I remember when I was like 3 or 4 and I would like put on mum's nail polish and it was like little stuff like that where other boys weren't interested in the same things and my parents are quite open and like do whatever you want, etc. And in a way they like both worked full time, so they were sometimes like not able to be present, so they just didn't have any sense of like being able to say do this or don't do this, right? But then I remember when I was in school and like seeing other boys in school, like the way that behavior is policed around gender binaries and gender lines, like boys do this, girls do that. And so that would lead to things like boys would play sport in school. Boys would be the ones who play football, they do cross country, and girls would be the ones that go play violin or join the choir, you know, little things like that where like, oh, boys don't sing in the choir. Like how silly is that? And it's so preposterous when you say it out loud because it's like, well, that's absurd, right? Like what if a girl wants to play football, you know, what if she's really into trucks? You know why? So what?
Yeah, totally. What was Nikita like? Can you tell me about her?
Oh, annoying. Super annoying. Yeah, she's the most annoying. Like this is, I mean, this is the thing, right? Like I can tell you all the positive things about her, but I can also tell you how annoying she was. Like we grew up in the same house and lived side by side for about 16 odd years. And our bedrooms were next to each other and she was annoying. Like I remember one time, so I got this amazing speaker set, right? And it had like 5 speakers and then the subwoofer surround sound set up. And I set it up in my bedroom and it was epic. It was so good. And I would like listen to my favorite songs, Darude Sandstorm and others on there. And one time I came home and I saw that my speaker set was missing. And I went to her room and I saw that she had taken it from my room to use for dance practice. But mum had told her that it was okay. And it wasn't okay. Like this was, my issue was not with my sister. My issue was with the boss, the CEO, mum. And I went to Nikki's room and I saw that it was there. And I flipped out. I cracked out. I was so angry at her. I yelled at her. I probably called her names. And I was like, you're the worst sister. You're so bad. Like, oh my God, you spoiled brat. Get away with everything. And then I went to mum like, this is bullshit. Like, how can she get away with this? Whatever. Then about 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, I like, cooled down. I was like, that was excessive, like that's the speaker set, chill out bro, like honestly not a big deal. But she was sassy, right? Nikki was like, she would never yell back at you, but you'd know how she felt about the situation. Because when I went back to apologize and I like knocked on the door and I was like, hey Nick, I used to call her Nick, short for Nikita or Nikki, and I was like, hey Nick, I'm really sorry. And then she's like, go away. And I'm like, I'm really sorry. And she's like, go away. And then I said, you know, I just want to apologize. Please open the door. And then she starts playing on the speaker set she stole from my room. She started playing the One Republic and Timbaland song, Apologize. And I just hear like, it's too late to apologize, like through the door. And it gets progressively louder until like knocking on the door was futile because you wouldn't have heard it. And I just, how do you even stay mad at that?
Yeah.
Because it's so, do you know what I mean? Like, it's so clever. Like,
yeah,
it's like, I just want to apologize. And you just hear, like, it's too late, like, in the back. Yeah.
It's too late to apologize. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. I love it.
And then Timbaland in the back, like, like that. And you're just like, oh. But, yeah, she was very sweet and good-natured and just, a genuinely lovely human being. And one of the things that strikes me now, 6-plus years after she's gone, is that she was quiet and softly spoken, but she was someone who had this kind of warmth and like she was fierce on the inside, if that makes sense. Like she wasn't like outgoing fierce. She was like quietly fierce and quietly like confident in her own abilities and someone that would be there for you regardless of what you were going through. You know, obviously she made fun and we had like a lot of fun of each other, played practical jokes on each other. But we were lucky because we grew up separated 4 years in age. So the age gap wasn't so big that we were at completely different life stages. So like,
yeah,
we were able to connect on an intellectual level as well and a meaningful level. So yeah, she was annoying, but tempered with a lot of positive qualities of generosity, empathy, kindness, kindness in particular. Like honestly, I can't think of people that I've known that are so consistently kind.
Yeah.
You know, she was really, really kind. Really kind. Yeah.
What was your family like through those 16 years? Like, what's the dynamic like with your parents and with her and with you?
Yeah, right. So mum and I are the more outgoing types in the family. We're probably a little more extroverted. Mum in particular, like growing up, mum would host like big events. You know, she's very social, particularly before Nikki died. She's not so much anymore. And I think that's a change that's come about through grief and trauma and loss. But growing up, I remember having, like, we would have parties for like 100 people and our house would be like packed. It was like a 3-bedroom suburban house. and there were like 80 to 100 people, like once a month, once every 2 months. Like someone would be like, I want to have a birthday party. And mum would be like, yeah, I'll host it for you. And that was seemingly normal. So now I remember growing up later, like when I would watch MasterChef or something at university, and one of the judges would be like, so we're going to do a dinner party and you've got 10 people coming over and you're stressed. And I'm like, 10 people? What? That's not stressful. Like, that's easy. Like, give me 15 minutes notice, if that. Like, we're set.
That's a weeknight.
Yeah, that's standard, right? And I think that's true for a lot of migrant families, right? Like, I don't think that's unique to mine. I think that we look at, like, gatherings of 10 people and we're like, oh, yeah, like, where's everyone else? You know, or when it's weddings and you hear like, oh, there's 50 people coming to the wedding. And then you're like, oh man, like where's the rest of the family? Like, are you not on speaking terms? What's going on? And then, you know, like the big events were just the norm, you know? Yeah. So growing up, we had a lot of love, like within our own family and a lot of love within the community. And love was shown in ways where it wasn't always like, you'd never say like, I love you. But like when I'm studying, my mum would just like cut up fruit and bring it to me and just give it to me. And like, I didn't ask for fruit, but I was hungry, right? But she would just cut it up and like give it to me. And my dad does that now. Like he does it. Like, I can't remember the last time my dad said, I love you, but like he cut up fruit yesterday and he just brought it to me. He's like, here.
And I was just, he like, says it with the fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, and I reckon people from, you know, non-Anglo migrant backgrounds will relate to it. Cause it's just, I don't know what it is, but it's just like, it's the way it happens. Yeah. And then there's other things where I've seen in families, like dynamics between sons and fathers where they'll have, like, I've had this conversation with a male friend of mine and he was like, I know my dad loves me, but I don't think he respects me because like, I don't know any of the things that he knows, you know, and his dad is very like hands-on, you know, he's a mechanic. He's like, I don't know how to do anything with my hands. Like, I don't know how to change the car tire. I don't know how to do anything. Like, I just know how to call RACV or whatever. I just know who to call if something happens, but I don't know how to actually fix it. He's like, so my dad loves me, but he doesn't respect me because I'm not his vision of a man. And it's a strange thing where, like, I think there's extra challenges and pressures on men from migrant backgrounds to fit into certain stereotypes because there's a lack of understanding across generations of the shifting nature of masculinity and definitions of what being a man actually means and what it includes.
Mm. Yeah, totally. How did your dad and your mom and you, I guess, cope with that grief of losing Nikita? Was it different for each of you?
Yeah, definitely. So mum is quite a spiritually minded person. So last conversation, I think she believes in a god or gods or something. And so she prays quite a lot, but not in any way that like, and I don't know why I feel the need to qualify this. I think it's because like, I think people assume praying in like a Judeo-Christian sense, but it's not like that. She's Hindu. And so it's a bit different, but like, you know, when there's like lunar calendar events on, like she'll pray in her little temple and she'll have her girlfriends over who also share similar beliefs. And it's around like the social aspect of it more than anything, you know, like being together. And obviously a lot of food is almost always food is involved when it comes to my family. So mum kind of coped in a way around spirituality, meditation, also doing a lot of community work. Mum has done. So like the strange thing is that like I've been recognized for a lot of the things that I've done in the community, which I mean, I'm very humbled by it and grateful to receive that acknowledgement. But the reality is that my parents, particularly my mum, is behind a lot of that. Like she, you know, if I've ever written something and I've needed someone to cast an eye over it, I've asked my mum, you know, because she knew Nikki better than anyone. She gave birth to Nikki. there is a certain bond there that a parent shares with their child, particularly mothers. You know, the mother's loss is so profound, having grown that child in their body and then giving birth to that child. There's a certain spirituality around that experience, right? So that kind of, that connection, it endures. And so mum's grief is something that it's not as visible now, you know, like she doesn't visibly cry or she doesn't look upset, but it's there. Like, and dad's is similar, but dad grieved in a different way to mum. An example of that, Claire, is when, so Nikki was murdered on the 9th of January, 2015. Her funeral was on Wednesday, the 21st of January, 2015. And then the following week, after the 26th of January public holiday, dad went to work. And so his daughter, his second child and only daughter, had been murdered 3 weeks prior. Mm. And dad was back at work. And I remember saying to mum, this is fucking insane. What is dad doing? Why is he going to work? And my mum was just like, shh, like, this is what's right for him. Like, he needs to do that because he needs something for his mind to be occupied. Otherwise, he'll spiral. And I didn't get it because I couldn't. I remember going back to work and I remember sitting in like a work in progress meeting or something like on a Monday morning and, you know, the team director's there and everyone's talking about things. And I just remember thinking, what the fuck? Like, wow. But I also felt the same in work situations when Robin Williams died. I remember sitting in a similar meeting and everyone was just like talking about like whatever. And I was just like, are we fucking serious? Robin Williams just died. Like, we should all go home and pack up our, like, we should all go home and all put the movie on the TV in the meeting room here and like watch Good Morning Vietnam or Mrs. Doyle. You know, I don't know. I think that way when certain legends of any kind of industry die, it's like, wow, like we lived in the same time as them. Like we were the beneficiaries of their art and their creativity. But I remember like when Nikki died, it was like, yeah, I couldn't go back to work. My dad did. Mum grieved in her way around meditation, spirituality, and I mean, she still keeps that up. For me, advocacy and campaigning, and I've come to learn this now in more recent years with the benefit of hindsight, Claire, that was its own form of handling grief. It was similar to my dad, I think, that my dad needed something to occupy him. And so for me, it was like regular work didn't cut it anymore. You know, and there was a period of like probably 2 or 3 years of campaigning and advocacy where I did that like 18 to 20 hours a day. Like I didn't sleep much at all. And I still don't sleep probably a healthy amount, right? And so there's a bit of like, do as I say, not as I do when it comes to that aspect of self-care. Because it's like I could benefit from probably sleeping more than 5 to 6 hours a night. But the thing is, for me, that's what it was. It was like, I need to do something. I need to feel like I'm occupying myself. And so it started with no plan in mind because it was so raw and so new. You know, I didn't work in social justice or anything before. I didn't work in those sectors. So I had no concept of it. It was just, this terrible thing has happened. What do I do? And so I just started doing what I thought was right. And one thing led to another, really. And so 3 years was just like consistently on. And then I realized that, hang on, this is not sustainable. This is not useful to other people, let alone myself. I need to manage it better. I need to be able to manage my emotions, look after myself. And also a realization that my sister would have wanted me to be happy. You know, that like I can't, it's a cliche that you can't pour from an empty cup. And it's true. Like you can't. So it was kind of taking a step back and being like, how am I going to look after myself more throughout that process? Mm. But we all, as a family, we all handled it so differently. And we continue to this day. And I think one of the things about grief is that it doesn't follow a linear timeline. You know, we talk about like the 5 stages of grief. They're not a timeline. There's probably a 6th one, which is just hating everyone and everything, including yourself, right? But we don't talk about that. Like we don't talk about the sorts of ways that grief manifests, which is just like, I mean, the anger stage can be, you know, so profound and so strong. And for me, like when you lose someone to murder, murder is a very profound way for someone to die. So it certainly stirs up a lot of emotions of anger, but it requires a degree of introspection and thinking about what's happened to come to peace with it.
Mm. Have you come to a place of forgiveness? Is that even possible in that kind of situation?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I've heard of people who have forgiven. I've heard of people who've forgiven and, like, spoken to the
perpetrator,
the perpetrator or the person that killed a loved one, and actually said, you know, to their face, "I forgive you." Thing is, what happened with my sister's murder is that the man who killed her didn't think that he was in any way morally responsible for what happened. Like, he still blamed her after the fact, blamed my parents, to a lesser extent blamed me, but he wasn't one to blame himself. You know, like, he didn't really show much remorse throughout the process, the criminal trial process, all of that. He entered a guilty plea because there was no question as to whether or not he did it. Mm. And so for me, forgiveness comes down to two things. You can forgive someone when they apologize to you, but more than that, you forgive someone through your actions and things. So I don't think of it as like, I forgive him for what he did. I think of it more as, I don't focus on what he did because it does not serve me in my life, you know? And so I just try to focus on doing what I think is good. And I don't, to be frank, like, I don't think about him other than when we're like having this conversation. I don't think about him on a day-to-day basis. I think about my sister a lot. Mm. And this is one of the things, right? Like, when we talk about what people will say, like Nikki's story, it's fascinating to me because what they're often referring to is Nikki's death. But she was a performing artist and a choreographer. And so to me, her story is the art that she was creating or that she wanted to create, the good that she brought into my life and the lives of others and her aspirations. That's her story. When some people refer to her story, they're talking about the act of her being killed, really, and the, you know, what preceded that. That's his story, really. That's not her story. She's like a supporting actress in that.
Mm.
You know, he's the main person that decided to do that. And I think when we look at it like that, I think it's part of a fundamental shift which would center perpetrators at the heart of the crime, that it's their choice to commit this action. And they do it on someone who is innocent and defenseless.
Mm.
And I think if we thought of it that way, we would actually see a shift in victim-blaming narratives, that it's like it's not their story at all. They're just wrapped up in it through no choice of their own.
Mm.
And Nikki was the same.
Yeah, it's like those headlines that are focused on the victim rather than focused on the perpetrator or worded in a way that don't kind of point the finger to the, yeah, it being the man's story, like, oh, you know, perfect dad murders his family or something, you know, like, yeah, there's some really, yeah, difficult things around the way that we talk, yeah, about perpetrators.
Or it'll be less direct, even, Claire, I think, than that. Like, it'll say, like, in my view, it'll say something like, perfect dad pushed to the brink, something like that. And then, you know, comma, tragedy follows.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just like, and then it's like, oh, and then it'll go through, a father of three killed his children before taking his own life. And then it'll have a neighbor saying, oh, he was such a great man, I never would have expected it. And it's just like, who are we providing a eulogy for here? Like, are we providing it for the man that killed his, you know, and let's use a real life example. This happened with Hannah Clark's murderer and the killer of her three children, Rowan Baxter, took their lives. And the way that he was framed after the killing, like in the media, the way that he was framed was so astounding, because it was like, you would think that this was a person that was the victim of tragedy themselves. But in actual fact, they committed, you know, quadruple homicide,
mm-hmm,
killed four people and then took their own life.
Mm.
Right? Like, that's fucked, right?
Yeah.
But we talked about it. The media originally talked about it, like, what a sad day this former footballer, you know, has been driven to this point. We had a police commissioner at the time, I don't recall his name, but he was saying, like, we don't know the circumstances of what drove him to that. And it was just like, what do you mean? Like, what are the circumstances? And it was like circumstances around his family life and the separation. And I just think, well, in its own way, Hannah Clark, for not wanting to be with him, was proven right, because when she was free, finally, he killed her. Similarly with Nikki, you know, people were like, well, why does she want to leave him? And I'm like, well, why do you think?
Mm.
Look what he did.
Yeah.
So the parallels with women who find themselves as as victims, as homicide victims of intimate partner violence, are so eerie because they're so similar, you know, that like the control and abuse escalates and escalates and escalates, and then eventually it culminates in murder. And so for me, like, it's so important to get to the roots of that around entitlement and boys' behavior and get to the prevention side of things. Because I think it's so much easier to fix something at that stage before it's happened than, you know, when we're dealing with families that are torn apart. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to fix something after the fact. Like,
What can we do then in terms of prevention? You were speaking about how we get to that point. Well, before we get to that point where someone is murdered or violence is committed, what are some of the things that you've seen work or that you think could work in circuit breaking, I guess, this kind of pattern of violence that we're seeing across our country?
What a fascinating question. I think that it comes down to people, particularly male role models with influence, modeling the kinds of behavior, you know, and accepting their influence and using it for good. So, for example, when we saw Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister talk about how not all disrespect ends in violence, but all violence begins with disrespect. What a powerful statement from a Prime Minister, you know, a leader of a nation standing there in no uncertain terms talking about the need to be respectful of women. And if we contrast the current Prime Minister, Prime Minister Morrison, against his predecessor, Malcolm Turnbull, and we look at how on International Women's Day, Prime Minister Morrison got up and said, we want women to rise, but not at the expense of others. And it's such a strange statement to make, because it's like, we want women to rise. That's it. That's full stop. That's the sentence, that we want women, because women aren't rising to positions of power at the rate that is having them in, you know, represented in equal terms.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like 13% or something of women in this country as CEOs or something like that.
Yeah, it's the statistics are, and it's lower for women of color, women from migrant backgrounds, or those with gender diverse identities. Like, that's talking primarily around, you know, if we, and that's why I'm such a strong advocate for intersectional feminism. You know, any feminism that not only thinks across gender lines, but also includes all human beings based on the intersection of factors that disproportionately impact them in addition to gender. So, for example, Aboriginal women have some of the worst health and economic outcomes of women anywhere in the world. And it's like, to me, that's unacceptable, you know. But if we only advocate for a kind of a corporate boardroom feminism, we're not going to help those women. So we need to have like whole of community approaches to feminist thought and feminist practice. And I mean, that's where I sit. But we've got a leader who is finding it difficult to grasp the extent of women's experiences. You know, he needed his wife to clarify for him, and he needed his, you know, to have an extension. He needed to have women in his life that he could understand the issue of violence towards women or disrespect or harassment towards women in reference to. Like, he needed to think that his daughters were in Brittany Higgins' position or in Grace Tame's position. And I just think, as long as we have men in positions of power who need to view women as an extension to themselves or an extension of a man, we're not going to make the progress that we need.
Exactly, because I think at the heart of that, about what he said, at the heart of that was that women are not people and human beings. Women are women, a subset of men, to be in service of men, to be, I don't know, idolized or whatever it is, married, girlfriend, mother, but they're not a person with autonomy, with feelings, with wants, with desires, worthy of respect, just as a man is. And I know we talked briefly when we first met about this idea that it starts in locker rooms and as teenage boys and men talking about women from that male gaze, right? Not talking about them as someone who has their own voice and needs and desires, even from a sexual perspective. And I think that's, for me anyway, I see where the danger starts before even we get to the point where men are even in relationships, when they see women as a goal to achieve, you know, to get, like in American Pie, to get that girl to sleep with them,
yeah,
rather than to understand who she is and for them to be on a more equal intellectual footing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's really sad too that we can kind of perpetuate that idea that women are, you know, just objects.
Yeah, it's terrible. And like it's so depressing as well, because it limits the extent of the male experience. It has, and this is what I was trying to explain earlier, is it obviously has effects on women, but it also has effects on men, you know? So, but I just don't think that the effects on men are the reason that we should be trying to tackle it. You know, I think that's what's sort of messed up a little bit now, is that like we're still in a point where like men require centering everything upon themselves in order to think that it's worth doing, you know. And I think that we need to be able to learn to flex that empathy muscle as boys and men to think beyond ourselves, to go outside of our own experience, our own lived experience, and go, wow, there is 50% of the population that is immediately experiencing the world in a somewhat different way to the way that men experience, right? And then going beyond that to actually understand more. And it's a process. Like, it's not something that, for me, it's not something that is a site of blame. It's not like we're blaming men collectively or individually for the actions of others. We're actually inviting men into a space to say, reflect on your own experience, reflect on the experiences of others. And I think that this poses certain problems for us culturally, because we live in a culture that is quite individualistic and quite oriented around individual goals and individual success. And if we contrast to Aboriginal cultures and First Nations cultures or certain migrant cultures, you know, which are arguably more community-centered and community-oriented, it makes for situations and places where change can actually occur probably quicker in those communities, because they think about the collective. You know, they have the collective family structure. They think about things a little bit differently. And I think we could do to learn from each other. You know, we could learn from the way things are done in other countries to go, oh, how do they view certain family units? How do they view the role of women? There are certain cultures around the world, you know, in African nations and elsewhere, that are not led by men. They're not patriarchal led. They're matriarchs. You know, the woman is the figurehead of the family or the community. And they have within them lower rates of violence towards women. They have greater acceptance of women's autonomy over reproductive choices. They have greater decision-making afforded to women. And I think that when we have those situations in place, we all collectively benefit. You know, like if we look at countries led by women during this pandemic, Jacinda Ardern as Prime Minister of New Zealand, Angela Merkel as, you know, Chancellor in Germany, we're seeing the way that they're managing the situation, and they're doing a fantastic job. They're doing a phenomenal job. You know, and even the men who are doing a good job globally are the men who outwardly espouse gender equality views.
Completely.
You know, because they're probably taking into account the views of women in their teams. You know, like Brett Sutton as the chief health officer in Victoria, you know, and he speaks openly about the need to get more women working in science and medicine and those fields. And I just think that if they're the views that that person holds publicly, then that would factor into their decision making. So that if a woman, for instance, you know, a young junior female colleague of his comes up with a suggestion, that he will actively consider it. He won't go, oh no, this is a young girl, what is she going to know? You know, because a good decision comes from a good idea, and a good idea can come from anywhere.
Totally. And yeah. I think, I mean, it's backed up by the research, right? That workplaces and companies that have greater diversity in terms of people of color, but also women from a gender perspective, just do better. They make more money. They function better as a collective. Yeah. And then also I was looking a little bit into some of the research around Melinda Gates and her kind of looking at poverty and communities in developing nations, and even climate change. And one of the big markers is educating women, which seems, you sort of think, well, how is that going to help climate change? But once women are empowered within their communities, the research shows that they are then the ones who are bringing their children into the world with better education. They work in this collective way. And obviously, you know, we're making big stereotypes, but if you look at, you know, massive, you know, millions and millions of cohorts of people, the research is there. It makes sense that women think in a more collective way, maybe for our own survival, maybe from, from hundreds, thousands of years ago when we were living in on the land in that way.
Yeah.
You know,
it does. It does, it does factor in. And like there's a state in the southern part of India, Karnataka, and they have one of the highest rates of literacy and numeracy for young women. And then that leads to younger women later in life having fewer children. So they'll have one or two children rather than having 8 or 10 or 12, as is customary in other parts of developing nations. And that is linked to literacy and numeracy levels. So the role of women shifts from being simply those who bring children into the world to being those who do whatever they want to do, you know, though. And so they have, it's strange. Like if you visit that part of India, it doesn't look like other parts of India with like rural settings and agriculture of the land and things like that. It looks like a modern metropolitan city. And it's strange for people to grasp, because if you go there, it's like, wow, this is progress is what occurs when we empower women to the fundamental right to education, you know? And so it's so crucial, because it's like it's a no-brainer because we all benefit. So why wouldn't we do the things that result in all of us benefiting? You know, this is not a zero-sum game where like there's a finite amount of pie and like if we give it to a certain number of people, that's it runs out. Like this actually continues to grow the more that we actually nurture and empower a greater number of people.
Completely. I mean, it goes right back to what Scott Morrison was saying about that ridiculous notion that by women rising, we have to make sure that other people don't lose out, which is really what he's saying there, is that men will lose out if women rise. You know, we're worried about men losing a piece of the pie, when really it's women rising, all ships rise. You know?
100%.
And maybe, you know, the way our workplaces will look and the way men's lives and women's lives will look will be different.
Yeah.
But really the research shows better.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Like we have this thing where certain organizations will still have things like maternity leave or paternity leave rather than like parental leave, right? And it's like create situations where those who are in parenting relationships can raise their children in what way suits them, you know, and that may mean that the woman continues to work or returns to work earlier and the man takes on a nurturing function with the children, you know, and is more actively involved day to day and allow them to do so without judgment, you know, like that this is not like the woman is choosing her career over her children. Right. But this is what works for the family, because we still see that play out in popular culture and the media around the narratives that happen. You know, like when women, I remember Mum and I having this conversation when she went for job interviews in the early 1990s here, they would ask her, do you have children? Do you plan to have children? And how old are your children?
Wow.
My dad was never asked that kind of stuff.
No.
You know, and my mum was so new to Australia at the time. Like she didn't even know. Like she just answered them honestly. And then she's like, I'd go for job interview and job interview after job interview. And I would just tell them, I go, you know, she'd say, oh, I have a beautiful young son and he has asthma and I love him a lot or something like that. And then she'd never hear back. And she was overqualified for the role she'd interview for. And you piece it together now and it's like she'll say now, she'll be like, they weren't asking me because they cared. They were asking me because they wanted to know how much time I'd need out of the office.
Yeah, exactly.
And she didn't realize that then. She was like, you know, she was like back then, like her friends are like, you know, they'll say about her, Nilu, you're so like innocent and bubbly and sweet. Like you didn't even realize that they were asking you because they were like data mining information about you to see like, is she the right candidate for us?
Yeah, yeah.
And Mom's like, no way. I just thought they were being nice, you know, because I would ask like, do you have children? Because I'm interested in people's personal lives and that's who my mum is, right? And I'm a little bit the same. Yeah, like yeah. If I'm like, do you have children? I'm not like, there's no adverse judgment. I'm like, wow, you have a family. That's great. Like, tell me about your kids, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so my mum innocently thought that's what it was all about. And it clearly wasn't. And then eventually, like, she got into certain, you know, jobs later. But, like, yeah, it was all because of this stigma around women and the role of women in society. And I think it's so important for me, like growing up in Australia, although I come from like a migrant background and I'm Indian Australian, it's so important. Like, this is where I live. This is my home. This is where I'll continue to live. And if vaccination rates stay the way they are, this is where I'll live forever. Like, I will never, I will never leave.
We will never leave.
I will never leave. Right. But if, I mean, if that's like, to me, it's like, well, that's where I live. Why wouldn't I want things to be better here? You know, and because I can sometimes will log on to social media and there'll be someone writing like, fuck off where you came from, or, you know, probably typing on their phone. They're like, get fucked, you know, you don't belong here. Or if it's so shit here, why don't you leave? And I'm like, man, I don't think it's shit here. I just, I say this stuff because I want us to be better, you know, like,
yeah. Completely. Right. I have two questions to ask you.
Yeah.
I know we've been talking about ages and I've so valued this conversation. My first question is, how do you deal with that feedback? Because you get a lot of feedback, right? Positive, negative, people giving you stories because of the work that you do and the incredible work that you do.
If I feel low about myself, I just post a picture where my eyelashes are clearly visible and I get like a whole lot of praise. And, you know, look at my eyelashes. Look, check that out.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Man. I feel for those eyelashes.
Look at that. Look at that. Look at that.
Those are beautiful.
The worst part is I'm probably serious about what I just said. So embarrassing. No, it's a lie to say it doesn't faze me. Of course it affects me, but it doesn't faze me that much, right? Because like people write the dumbest things on the internet. They write the most like ridiculous statements on the internet because they think they can get away with it, right? And I we forget, for instance, that Facebook was set up by a guy who wanted to rate women in his cohort at Harvard.
I know.
But we forget that the very thing that so many of us use now to stay connected to friends and family around the world, and we use in a completely different way, was literally like a way for college-aged men in the United States to rank and objectify other women and have these locker room type discussions around them. Right. And so like people take that on board. They look at the internet as being like distinct from real life. The way I think of it though, is that like the internet is an extension of real life. Like people in the community actually harbor those views. They just know that there are real life consequences to saying that and they don't do it. Right. So if someone said something racially motivated, like a discriminatory statement against me or anyone else in public, there would be hopefully meaningful consequences in real life. People hide behind a degree of anonymity on the internet, but they still have those views. Those views don't just exist in digital platforms. You know, so like, now, not that we can go now, but like if I'm in a large shopping center space like Chad Stern or anywhere like that, if you look around, it's like there's some racists here. There's some homophobes, there's some transphobes. There'll be all kinds of people here just doing their shopping, going about their lives. And there'll be like open-minded people, there'll be closed-minded people, all kinds of people, right? And then when they get on the internet, they're just like, yeah. And so for me, I look at it like the people who are trying to do any good in the world or creating something and putting it out there have a different energy. They have a different vibe. They're not critical of other people, right? Because they know how hard it is, right? Like it's such a pleasure to sit on this podcast with you and talk to you, right? Because it's like you're so amazing and you put all this stuff out there and I've listened to like other episodes. Aww. And it's like fuck, man, this is cool. Like, this is a different energy. Like, there's a different energy around people who are creative and trying to do good. And so I just like, I'm like, if I'm going to come to that person for advice in real life and they have a criticism of me, then it's probably going to be well worded or it's probably going to be like with my best interests at heart. But if someone is just like sounding off, then I mean, go on, like, sure. And the thing that's cool though, right now, and like this blows my mind. Someone will write something on the internet, negative, right? Or discriminatory. And it used to be that if I didn't respond to them, they would just keep going or they would just say it once and shut up. Now, other people that I don't know, strangers, will be like, hey, you shouldn't say that. That's not okay. And I'm like, whoa, this is wild. There are people that I don't know, but we're on the same team. Incredible.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the energy that you're putting out into the world, I think, because you model behavior that you want to see, right?
I try to.
Yeah.
I try. And like Yeah, it's, I mean, like, it's the internet. Like, who take, like, don't take it too seriously. Like, it's it can be dangerous, you know. Certainly, it can be, and it can be used as a tool to facilitate abuse and things. But the idea that it only exists in the internet and because of the internet, I think that's what I don't necessarily agree with. The idea that it's just like it occurs more on the internet, arguably, because people can hide behind certain things, you know. And so for me, it's about stamping out the attitudes in the first place, as much as it is about protection on the internet. It's the same as, like, you know, preventing violence against women. You have prevention on one end, and then you have criminal justice system response on the other. By the time it gets to the response end, lives have been ruined. So I would rather work to instill safe behaviors online that are around what you say and believe and think and put out there, rather than just particularly, and it's always on groups who are already marginalized. Like, it's always on, say, the LGBTQI plus community to go, how do you protect yourselves online? And it shouldn't be like that. It should be like, don't write homophobic things on the internet. Don't think them. Like, be accepting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's my last question.
Sure.
Listeners to this show, we have a lot of blokes that listen, and women and people from all different places all over the world. If they want to be an ally in this space,
yeah,
what are the things they can do?
Okay, let's say to create a more, and we can put anything like gender, race, sexuality, to create a more equal world in any of those spaces or places, I would say start listening. Start listening to and seeking out, and the internet's amazing for this, whether it's Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, right? There are so many creators who are putting out amazing content. Feels like the wrong word, because it's not just content. It's like an education, the things that one can learn in those spaces, because the means of production lie with these creators now, that they can just, they've got a phone in their hand and they can put something out there. And the more we listen and then reflect before we speak, the more that we grow as people. You know, this is actually an exercise in self-respect and self-growth and personal development that has flow-on effects for the rest of society. So for me, what I try to do is I try to seek out content from people that are different to me, that aren't just affirming the same identity that I have. So I will look beyond my own experience to go, oh, what is the experience of trans people? What is the experience of women who are refugees? What is the experience of, in my case, men who occupy positions of power in boardrooms? What is their experience? And listen to the whole gamut of things, you know, but particularly for people who want to be allies to women, is listening to women and allowing women to have space that for a very long time they haven't had. You know, I think where men are in a position now, particularly men in positions of power, where they're patting themselves on the back, like, aren't we doing so great? We have 40% of women on our boards now, or we're at this point. And it's like, no, man, like we're just starting. Like, we're really just starting. And it's only been like 18 months or something. Like, it's the space of one annual report where things are looking different on paper, but the actual meaningful change is going to take time.
Mm.
And so for me, that's my advice. It's pretty straightforward. Listen, like, really listen and hear, and then be okay with the discomfort, you know, that you're not under attack. So for instance, something that I say to men a lot is that if a woman says that she finds something sexist, hear her out, listen to what she has to say. Don't take it as an immediate opportunity for yourself to respond. Don't think you're under attack. It's not an attack against you as a human. It is a statement of her experience. Validate that experience. Listen to that, hear it, and then reflect on what it is about yourself, others, men in your life, society at large, that has created a space where that experience that she's detailed to you is statistically so common among so many women. You know, and then that opens, and then that's empathy, right? That's empathy in action. You know, it's actually trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes. Like, we're at a point now where probably having sympathy towards women. We're like, oh, that's awful that happened, or it's awful that, you know, you're a subject of discrimination or sexism. But we're not actually at a point of empathy of going, what, you know, what's leading to that? What can we do, and how awful must it feel to feel ostracized, to feel alone, to feel unsafe, you know, in any space, whether it's in the home or outside? We're not at a point where collectively, particularly around gender, men are having empathy for the experience of women, you know? And so I think having that and nurturing that is a process that leads to better outcomes for everyone.
Mm. Very well said. Thank you so much, Tarang. That was just brilliant. And there's just so many pearls of wisdom in there as well. So I could talk to you all day, actually.
I love talking to you.
It's so fun. We'll have to do another episode maybe down the track.
Yeah, I'd love to.
You've been listening to a podcast with me, Claire Tonti, and this week with Tarang Chawla. For more from Tarang, you can head to his website, tarangchawla.com, and there's a link just below in the show notes. You can also follow him over there on Instagram where you can go and find a beautiful picture of her baby, his gorgeous dog. Okay, I'm Claire Tonti and I tell stories sometimes over on Instagram at Claire Tonti, or you can find all of my podcasts at my website, clairetonti.com. I also have another podcast called Suggestible where I make fun of my husband once a week and give you recommendations for books and recipes and Netflix and TV shows and films and all kinds of things, and that comes out every Thursday. So you can head on over there. And as always, thank you so much to Raw Collings for editing this week's episode. If you love this show, I would so love you to subscribe, rate and review just over there in app. It really makes a massive difference. And just share it with someone. If you love this episode, text it to a friend, share it with someone over Facebook. It would just make so much difference to me and allows this show to be discovered and for me to keep making it. All right, and that is it from me this week. Sending you all lots and lots of love and hope you're doing all right out there in whatever situation you are in. Till next week. Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.